We are back, and we are pleased to have on this segment of the program Dr. Michael Parenti to discuss the media. The political bias in the U.S. news media is one of Dr. Parenti's specialties. He received his Ph.D. in political science from Yale University in 1962 and has taught at a number of colleges and universities. He lectures on college campuses and before a wide range of audiences across North America and abroad. Michael Parenti is the author of 17 books, including The Terrorism Trap. Some 250 articles of his have appeared in Z Magazine, New Political Science, Monthly Review, The Humanist, Dollars and Cents, The Nation, and numerous other publications. He appears on radio and television talk shows to discuss current issues and ideas from his published works. Dr. Parenti's talks and commentaries are played on radio stations and cable community access stations to enthusiastic audiences in the U.S., Canada, and abroad. He has written two books that I think are particularly relevant to a discussion of the U.S. media. 1993, Inventing Reality, The Politics of the News Media, and Make Believe Media, The Politics of Entertainment, 1992. Now, we talked last week a bit about the book Censored 2003, the top 25 censored stories produced by Project Censored, which has been an ongoing concern for 20 years now. Dr. Michael Parenti is currently one of the national judges for Project Censored, and we're very interested, particularly in their chapter on the top 10 media giants. Welcome, Dr. Parenti. How did you get involved with Project Censored?
I was invited to become one of the judges, and I readily accepted because I thought it was a worthwhile project. It tries to highlight the fact that you can have forms of censorship in what is ostensibly a free society. That censorship does not necessarily require a government censor who sits there to pass on stories. There are, in fact, in the major networks, there are offices of standards, they're called. They have very neutral-sounding names like that. And they actually do pass on what kind of shows can be shown on the networks. But not only about concerning morals and that stuff, but also political. In fact, if anything, on many moral issues, controversial issues, you know, references to gays or family values, this or that, they've become much, much more open. But they still rein in and pull in things that have a political content. That's in the entertainment media. But in the news media also, you have a constant, albeit informal, censorship from editors, from bureau chiefs, from publishers themselves. In the New York Times, Sulzberger sits every day with his editors and decides what's going to go in the editorial page. He'll even call up stories that are in the paper itself, especially the front page, and question or challenge them, and they'll be killed if he says so. So you have owners that are censoring. You have corporate advertisers who are censoring. With all that, you don't need a government censor. And the most common form of censorship is omission, which is what Project Censored. They point out stories that have gotten some exposure in some small outlets or publications here or there, or maybe one little brief passing mention on page 24 of the Washington Post or New York Times, but has never had the spotlight really put on it, and they could be very urgent kinds of issues that the American public should hear about. And how do we have a free citizenry if we don't have people being able to be informed about what's going on?
Well, Project Censored has Censored 2003 out currently in bookstores, the top 25 censored stories, of which you were one of the judges. I think at some point in this book, the founder, Carl Jensen, Dr. Carl Jensen, says that in the past 25 years, he thinks that what seems to be the biggest story of the past quarter century is censorship in the media itself. And there's an extensive chapter in the book on who owns what. And I think this is it not a subject near and dear to your heart?
Yeah, I wrote a book called Inventing Reality about that whole subject, which came out, by the way, 2 years before Manufacturing Consent. But you can actually see a change in the anti-war demonstrators. There are many, many more than there were, say, 20 or 30 years ago. There are many, many more references in the signs that they carry and comments that are made by speakers to the distortions in the media and how the media doesn't tell us the whole story about, for instance, the impending war on Iraq or some other basic issue. So people are becoming increasingly aware of how the the mainstream media really do dish up the news and serve as mouthpieces for the powers that be. And, you know, and then distortion comes not only in omission and suppression, but also in what they do tell us about. And the way they do it, often their professed neutrality can be. Look at the treatment, for instance, of the Iraq war that's pending. Well, what they've done is made that war very acceptable through a process of normalization.
Right.
We get shows on TV, if the U.S. does invade Iraq, right, here's where the troops will do, and this is what they'll do, and these are the missiles we'll use, and they're very accurate, mm-hmm, and this and that says this. There won't be too much collateral damage, and this is going to happen, and this new jet will be in place. Mm-hmm. Making, after you watch 15 minutes of that, the war doesn't sound too bad, you know? I mean, you're getting all fixed and ready for it, you know? You're getting all attuned to, mm-hmm, it, you know? And they haven't said, now mind you, Doug, they didn't come out and say, we support this war, we want this war in it. They don't do that. They just peel this all out and create that reality implicitly, that background reality that the dangerous man in the White House wants.
Talking about what they're going to serve in meals ready to eat, et cetera, all these background things
That's
that just
right.
make war like the most normal thing in the world.
Right.
We are speaking with political analyst, lecturer, and author, Dr. Michael Perini. I'd like to quote a quote from you, which I liked very much in your article, Methods of Media Manipulation, where you say the press itself is falsely labeled, quote, the liberal media, unquote, by the hundreds of conservative columnists, commentators, and talk show hosts who crowd the communications universe with complaints about being shut out of it. I think you nailed that one.
Right, thank you. I mean, it is true to hear the conservatives call it a liberal media, and it's so dominated by conservative commentators and such.
Well, I was very impressed in reading this article in Project Centered 2003, where the various media powerhouses were outlined. And I didn't realize that Time Warner, as of a few years ago, was the world's number one media corporation. That was before it even added AOL. At this, mm-hmm, point, it's worth revenues of like $40 billion. Number two, I guess, is Disney and the 20 billions of dollars.
Right.
And it does seem odd that this idea of a liberal media is so widely accepted in this country when it's clear that media giants are, by and large, controlling the flow of data.
Yeah, the reason they insist that it's a liberal media is because occasionally some stories do get out. Occasionally there's a story about Enron stealing billions of dollars from its honest workers and how these men are nailed. And, you know, some of them may actually end up doing hours of community service for the billions that they've stolen. So occasionally there'll be a story like that. Occasionally there's a story about a corporation that pollutes a lake and people have gotten sick and there have been birth defects. You know, so every so often, and when those things come out, that's when these conservatives are convinced that the media is out to get the business community and is against corporate America or something like that. But the truth is, all they're doing is giving the palest, most insufficient reportage of certain kinds of realities that do break through every so often. It's not that they're liberals, it's that reality is radical. When people say to me, is that your ideological view? I said, that's not my ideological view. When I say that Enron stole billions of dollars, that's reality. That's not my ideological view. When I say corporate America is one of the major polluters in the world and wants to keep polluting, that's reality. Maybe my ideology is what attunes me to go and look for those realities, but that's where they are.
Now, one that you cite in your article may be worth a little bit of commentary is the August 1996 story from the San Jose Mercury News, where Gary Webb investigated the CIA Contra crack shipments that had been flooding East LA. Now, I remember in the late 80s when this story was first raised its head, and it was sort of treated very matter-of-factly and dropped like a stone. 10 years later, Webb basically renews it, goes through and says, hey, what about this? And was pretty much, I guess as you would describe it, attacked and destroyed.
Yeah, because that time, the second time when Webb did this whole thing, the San Jose Mercury News, it got out. It wasn't just contained in that one little newspaper, pretty good newspaper, but it went around, it came out. Some other newspapers picked it up. It got into some radio programs. And all that. When that happens, then you have to attack the purveyor and you just destroy him and you say he was unreliable. The reports didn't sustain every single word and proof. Imagine if the New York Times ever tried to sustain an absolutely, totally ironclad confirm every story they ever ran in their paper. It'd be a very skimpy newspaper indeed. But in fact, what they overlooked is that Gary Webb had an awful lot of very troubling and very real information and testimony from former CIA operatives who said, yeah, we shipped this stuff in here and we did it and we raised money and we did the other things. And this was totally ignored. So what they'll do is they'll hit on maybe one weak point in a story that has 10 very strong points and one or two weak things, and then they'll say, this man is unreliable. And they really did a job on Gary Webb, who was a very conscientious and very capable journalist.
Yeah, my understanding was that their main beef was that he didn't have the right numbers. But his comment was, well, unless someone goes and opens the files in Washington and shows me what the invoices are, I'm not likely to come up with those.
Right. Exactly. And by the way, he was attacked by the New York Times and the Washington Post.
Right.
I mean, they had their marching orders on that one.
Right. The quote, liberal media, exemplars.
Exactly.
Well, but as you point out in discussing that case, this story got out and circulated around the world on the web, became too difficult to ignore, and then the media then began its assault.
Right.
The thing we're going to want to know in this is, what can we do given this reality of how much control there is in the hands of a select few? And the web has been pointed to as a sort of a democratic means of dissemination of information, and yet the corporations are moving into the web in a big way.
They really are looking for ways to rein it in, how they can do that. The internet, it's decentralized. It has many different locations and sites. You have all sorts of people just setting up things, including some probably who shouldn't, who don't even know how to do an interview, who now have actually audiences and such. I don't know how they're going to put that genie back in the bottle, but I think they will find some kinds of ways. They're always quickly easy, whether it's in the guise of fighting kiddie porn or fighting drugs or something, whatever. They may use some excuse. You have the internet. You still have a few hundred alternative radio stations around the country that do get some things in every so often. And you have small publications that sometimes carry things that are worthwhile. And, even in the mainstream media, if you read it closely, it's amazing what you can find. It's not framed or it's not honed in such a way as to tie the knots and all, but you can find information in there that's actually unintentionally very revealing about what the powers that be do and say and how they feel about things.
Are you optimistic that just basically getting the facts out there and knowing it can make a difference? That's something that I think this show and this whole station and many others like it is, founded on that premise.
I really do, because I think you get the stuff out there, you change consciousness. You change consciousness, that changes people's behaviors. You change people's consciousness, you won't have 66% of them supporting the president to go bomb Iraq. You may have very few. You begin to have people not even wanting to serve in such an endeavor. I saw that happen during the Vietnam era, where units would not even fight. Ultimately, if people's minds can be uncontrolled and decontrolled and freed out from the claptrap they've been fed since day one, and they can start seeing an alternative perspective and seeing what their own interests really are and what the interests of people all around the world is, our leaders really then have to behave in different ways.
We are talking to Michael Perenni about the media and America and the sorry state of current affairs. As we record this discussion, we seem to be on the brink of war. You've written a book addressing how things have gotten to this state since September 11th, your book, The Terrorism Trap, September 11th and Beyond.
The beyond is the key word there. I mean, I do talk about why it becomes necessary to have a global empire, why they becomes necessary to have a state of perpetual war, what the interests are involved there, what the attractions are. It's to make sure that we have a world that is totally open to free market globalism. It's to make sure we have a society that's under a kind of siege psychology with giant military budgets, where human services are cut back for the sake of this kind of militarism. It's the victory of Sparta over Athens, if you will. And that's what the book is about.
On this show, we talked a couple of months back about a man who warned us some time ago about the term he used was military-industrial complex, and that was stated by General Dwight Eisenhower, then President of the United States, a man who nobody can accuse of being, soft on the military. And yet these many decades later, we appear to have an entrenched military-industrial complex.
Military spending picks up the slack in overcapacity. I mean, if you look at the term they're all using, the problem that capitalism faces everywhere, Indonesia, Japan, the U.S., overcapacity. Well, when you start pumping $400 billion every year into military spending, that, first of all, absorbs. That is direct straight profits, straight contract profits. That doesn't create a public sector that's in competition with private corporations, really. It's just what the private corporations want. It's a kind of contracting that's non-competitive. The cost overruns are guaranteed. I mean, the profit margins are stupendous. And it's all being paid out of the pockets of the U.S. taxpayers. So military spending is a very big thing. And then there's always oil that's wanted to, and going into Iraq to get the oil. What I'd like to point out is we have a U.S. global empire today. The U.S. has about 360 or so major military bases all over the world. No other country seems to have that or seems to feel the need to have that. The U.S. has its fleets in every ocean. It has its bomber squadrons that could reach every city. It has a firepower that can destroy just about any country within a matter of a few weeks. There's no other country that's anywhere near that. The U.S. spends more than the next top 10 countries combined. It spends about $400 billion, and the next country on the list is Russia with about $50 or $60 billion. This to give you an idea of the magnitude of this U.S. military. And yet we have leaders who are kept pumping and hyping us up about this danger and that danger. And there was a terrorist attack, a terrible one, September 11. But bombing Afghanistan, bombing Baghdad, isn't going to stop six men with box cutters from hijacking a plane.
Right.
In fact, as far as counterterrorism and homeland security, they've been very negligent. They've been going after our liberties and our rights, but they haven't really been catching that many people, you know. There have been better jobs being done in Spain, breaking up cells, and in Germany and Italy and England. So I'm not too impressed by the war against terrorism. If you looked at George Bush Jr., he was exultant after September 11. He was saying, this is the first war of the 21st century, and we're going at it, you know. And he was just, he even said, this may turn out to be a good opportunity. And not only he, but the Wall Street Journal on September 13 wrote an editorial and said, now George Bush, the president, can push his conservative agenda right now, which means big jump in military spending, cutbacks in public services, tax cuts for the rich. And that's exactly what he did. He pushed all those things and rolling back our civil liberties. One thing that happens when people mobilize to defend their standard of living, then the government attacks not only their standard of living, but also their democratic rights, the rights they use to mobilize and defend that standard of living, the right to free assembly, the right to critical perceptions of things, the right to oppose and dissent. And they're trying to strip that away from us because democracy is still an encumbrance. It's a barrier to their rolling forth with their global free market agenda.
And under the guise of promoting free markets, we've seen giant mergers of already giant companies.
And along with mergers is the concentration of ownership. There used to be laws which said no one owner could own more than, what, one radio station,
right,
and one TV station and one newspaper in the area. Now the big guys can buy up everything. And, of course, the price of the radio stations has skyrocketed. And the ownership has concentrated increasingly, as big money comes in and buys up the radio stations. And you have now in cities where there's one owner who controls the newspaper, most of the radio stations, and the TV stations.
And I think most people don't realize that the fairness doctrine was pretty much rescinded in the 1980s. That the idea that you have to present programming that is balanced is by the boards a long time ago.
That's correct. The Fairness Doctrine said that if you were attacked, you could make a response. Equal Time Doctrine was for candidates, where the same thing worked. All of those have been suspended because they said these are restrictions on our freedom of expression, the media's freedom of expression. But of course, there were restrictions that tried to ensure a diversity or balance of opinion. And you see very little of that. You see less and less of that. You never did see all that much of it anyway.
Well, we're doing what we can to balance what's out there.
Right. Thank you for your work.
Well, thank you, sir. For more information on Dr. Michael Perini, you can go to his website, which is at www.michaelparenti.org. In addition to books we've already mentioned, Dr. Parenti is the author of History as Mystery, Land of Idols, Political Mythology in America, and The Sword and the Dollar, Imperialism, Revolution, and the Arms Race. Thanks again to Dr. Parenti. You're listening to Radio Parallax on KDVS 90.3 FM. I'm Douglas Everett. Let's take a break.